8th of July, 1995, San Francisco. Could you give us your complete name?
Nicholas Brian Jones.
And the place and date of your birth?
November 8th of 42 in Fargo, North Dakota.
Your mother and your father's complete names?
Clarice. God, what's her name? No, it's Patricia Clarice Jensen was her maiden name. And my father was Charles Percy Jones.
Can you tell us a little bit about them? For example, their occupations, where they were from?
Mm-hmm. My mother was raised on a farm in North Dakota, and her parents were from Sweden and were farmers and came
she
over.
She was first generation born in this country in that family?
Yeah. Oh. Mm-hmm. And my father, his background goes back many more generations, but he was from the Midwest, and he was born also in a small town in North Dakota. And his parents were cooks. His father was a cook, and mother, I guess, was a waitress, and they did a lot of things, including trapping animals for fur and income, and they lived pretty rough, poor life. They were pretty poor.
And your mother's people's occupation was?
Farmers.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right.
Wheat farmers.
Yeah. How about yourself, your education?
I went through 12 years of Catholic education in Fargo, and then off and on over like six-year period of time in college at North Dakota State University.
What do you remember? I mean, what was life like growing up in North Dakota at that time?
Well, the area I was raised in was right close to North Dakota State University, which was an old agricultural college. And we were a pretty rough bunch of kids, basically, I'd say, lower middle class or upper lower class. I'm not quite sure where to peg us. But we're mostly fairly poor kids, and we had a lot of fun. We were into a lot of mischief, and there was rarely a dull day in the years where I was out in the streets.
What were some of the kinds of things you did? This mischief, too?
We did everything. We stole apples and raided gardens and went over, rode animals on the state campus. We were into everything, we used to harass the campus police. It was kind of a ongoing 2 or 3 year battle between them and us, and so we had a lot of fun.
And this was when you were a student at a Catholic school.
Yeah.
How would you evaluate, assess the role, the impact of religion then in your life as you're growing up?
My folks were very Catholic, and my family was very Catholic, including myself. In fact, I was, and I think about it, the first demonstration I heard of, actually was close enough to hear, was I was on the altar, I think a freshman or sophomore in college. I was on the altar serving as an altar boy, or an assistant on the altar at the Newman Center, mm-hmm. where a demonstration was going by outside. So I was fairly serious about religion on the one hand, but as I got older, actually, as even my high school years, I got more and more, a little more skeptical and separated from it.
Do you remember what was driving that skepticism, and what were you thinking?
I'm not real sure. It certainly crystallized for me when I reached college and where I consider my radicalization took place. It crystallized. But I had some very good nuns and priests in my childhood as I grew up that were very good people that I continue to respect and remember. And I had a couple priests who helped really literally start me on a road radical road when I reached college.
Well, let's talk about that. Then you've mentioned a couple of times the radicalization taking place in your college ages, and you mentioned the two priests. So can you give us some idea that, you know, the change that's taking place in you, the transition, the phase now at that time?
Yeah. I guess really my radicalization started politically in the Newman Center on campus, so right off campus. And there were two priests there, one of whom was, I had known actually for maybe 10 years previous. His name was Father Hovda, and it turns out he tried, you know, to organize or help organize the bus drivers in our hometown. And the church ran him out of town. I didn't know that till later when I met him in the Newman Center, why he had left town several years earlier. But he was he had a real good outlook on religion and the Catholic Church. And he was very much involved with, what do they call it? There's a body in the Catholic Church that operates out of Washington, D.C. that deals with beliefs, Catholic beliefs and catechism and all of that. I forget the name. It'll probably pop into my head here. But he was very much into that and Pope John and the new changes coming in the church. And he was always, from the day I actually began any meaningful relationship with him, was very radical. You know, believed, you know, that things were wrong and bad and that we ought to be doing some stuff to change it. And so we did some things organizationally within the Newman Center that moved us in the direction of some civil rights support work for SNCC and bringing in speakers. And that moved into, very soon after, beginning activity against the Vietnam War. And that's kind of a walking contradiction, because I was going through and finished actually my ROTC at North Dakota State. I was on my way to become cannon fodder in Vietnam, and I was on this track finishing that as I was on this political track. And I was pretty key in organizing the only teaching on Vietnam on campus, when I had just completed my ROTC training. And I assumed that playing a leading role in organizing that teach-in against the war would get me booted out, but they were so hungry for cannon fodder, they wouldn't boot me out.
Yeah. But there were some tensions being created by your two roles, your two
parts. I never even thought seriously about what I was doing in ROTC. I just started it as a freshman and went through the 4-year program, and most of that time, assuming I'd come out and graduate and become a second lieutenant and do the good things that American boys are supposed to do. But by the time I was finishing that, I was had become quite radical and absolutely, against the war in Vietnam and all of those things. And I was pretty well. I probably haven't grown much politically since then. I think I was pretty mature by the fourth or fifth year there in college, and politically. And I think, looking backwards, that my politics were pretty accurate. Nothing much in my life has changed my mind on what makes this country tick and
what's wrong with it.
Who did you see? Who did you read? Who were the philosophical, ideological influences that were there?
I got into, probably because of the priests into this, I got into some of the Sartre and some of the philosophers, and forget their names now, but I read several of those books during that period. And, I think probably then almost from that graduated very quickly into things that were available through SDS and radical organizations on, you know, politics that were occurring at that particular point.
Julie Marcuse?
What was this?
Herbert Marcuse.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Counter-revolution and revolt.
Yeah.
London Mission.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I read some of that, you know, that was around. I don't even remember anymore, but I was reading. But most of my radicalization, you know, was going on in my head, occurred because of the people I was had become close to towards the end of my college career, and the people that we were dealing with then, because we were most of all of our free time and more was being devoted and headed towards anti-war activity and civil rights activity.
Okay. What we forgot to ask about, what were your parents doing, and then did you have siblings?
I have a brother and four sisters, and my parents, my father had a very healthy respect for his union. He helped organize back east in the maritime unions out there. He was on the seas for about 12 years, and you know, had spoken to us kids about that. And then he also was active in bringing the Carpenters Union into Fargo, and was a carpenter, a lifelong carpenter, and of course spoke of his respect for the union movement and you know, his pride in never crossing a picket line, and all of these things were kind of instilled in all of us kids. I was the most radical in the sense of putting my radicalism to work. I've got a couple sisters who have a pretty radical philosophy, I think, but never got involved full-time in movement kind of work. And my brother is a card-carrying Republican, and my other two sisters are good Democrats, but nothing in terms of being involved with political work directly.
So your family didn't react too strongly against your growing radicalism?
I put them through a lot of... it was quite a shock. I mean, a lot of things happened. I was engaged to be married to a woman who, his brother was the head of the whole ROTC program. You know, good people, but, you know, so that split started there. I mean, we ended the engagement, and I was doing all this radical off-the-wall shit in their eyes, and my parents were kind of assessing and seeing the same thing. You know, my father, I think, probably went to his grave never really relating anti-war activity with his principles, which were healthy on the union movement, for example. He could never make that kind of a connection. And probably the longest conversation I ever had with him was a very long argument over Cuba, which he had been in Cuba many times as a seaman. And we had long and hard arguments over Cuba. So, and my folks were very disappointed that I left college without a degree. I left college without getting my lieutenant bar, you know. So it was pretty fairly rough for them. But quite truthfully, and my mother, which I haven't said much about, she always had a very healthy respect for people and always open to helping people. You know, which I think it was I inherited and my brothers and sisters inherited, which was healthy. But again, both my father and mother were quite disappointed that I would go off this way. But I think within like 3 years or so of being with the Farm Workers Union, my folks really came around and understood it a lot better, and I think they were quite pleased later on in life that it, you know, I'd done that. But it didn't fit their view of the future, you know, at that time at least.
So what happened between you and the military?
They wouldn't throw me out. I thought they would cut me off. I went to the head of the military program, the colonel, and told him that, you know, my views on the war, and I couldn't go there, I would not go there, and I assumed again that he'd throw me out, and within, I don't know, a month or two of that, we had that anti-war teaching, and so nothing happened, and so I just said to hell with it, and I really don't even know how well thought out it was, but I left town. I just up and got my thumb out and hitchhiked to Chicago, went to work for SDS. And within about a month or so of being in Chicago, I was drafted.
and I went back to go through the ceremonies being drafted, and I filed conscientious objection papers and refused to take a step forward. And I filed the papers, and again, I wrote, took a lot of time and put a very lengthy statement about my conscientious views against the war and being in the military. And so that process started, you know, it kept me from going in. They were going to draft me as a non-com, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I did is I came back from Chicago after being drafted, did my conscientious work maybe over a week or two, and then I had already heard about and got very interested in the Farm Workers Union, who would put out an invitation for volunteers. This would have been the spring or so of 1966. And so I did my CO work in Fargo, and then with a couple other people, we drove out to California, and two of us joined the UFW.
Where did you see the invitation to join the UFW?
In periodicals, including the SDS newspaper.
Did you talk to anyone about joining up, or just?
Yeah, I did. Because of some experience, Fargo is in what's called the Red River Valley, mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of migrants that come up through there. And I had some experiences with some migrants, which had interested me in their situation. I happened to be working on a job on a farm where we were all doing exactly the same work, and I was getting, at that time, I suppose, $4 an hour, and they were getting like $1 an hour. And we mounted a little protest over that. So that's kind of a, you know, initiated some.
What kind of work were you doing?
We were actually doing some construction work, mm-hmm. on this farm. And they had these migrants who were apparently not being used in the fields at that time doing work
same,
right alongside
the same construction
of us,
work then.
But getting screwed, obviously, worse than we were. But I had had some experience that way, and had done some kind of liberal clothing drive crap and food stuff for migrants, mostly through the church in earlier years.
So that, given the location and the migrant stream that was taking place, the Red River Valley, this had been kind of, you know, the contact with agricultural labor or migrant labor was kind of a regular part of your...
Well, it was pretty limited, pretty limited. But at least it was there, and I had some experience, and I certainly made up my mind probably by the time I mm-hmm. was in college that migrants were getting screwed. Yeah. I had an uncle who, some distant uncle, I guess, who owned sugar beet land up in North Dakota, and he was like a regular exploiter of migrant labor. He, you know, I mean, he did the whole number and was very rich. So I had that little education, my background, and I had concluded anyway by, I think, the time I reached college that migrants were getting screwed and pretty deplorable. Living conditions and working conditions. I didn't know the labor union would be an answer to that, but mm-hmm. I've come to that conclusion. Where do we start here? What was the question?
Well, we're trying to figure out for the path and what brought you, what are the various elements coming together. So now,
so
you get in the car and you with a couple of people and come out to come out to Delano.
Yeah.
Well, and then you had asked too, had I talked to anybody. I talked with some people that had some
firsthand experience with NFWA at that time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, a little bit. You know, like they had big visited at Caesar, and so I talked with some of them in SDS, and I had nothing. I mean, I was just bumping along like a log in the river, I think. It looked interesting. And I did a little reading, whatever I could get my hands on in Chicago, and decided I'd like to try it. So I volunteered and picked up another radical friend of mine in Fargo, and about a week or two later, we drove out here.
And I think, if I remember right, that was the first volunteer program and where they threw a net out to try to get a large number of people. And I think something like 40 or 50 people went to work, theoretically, for the summer, right? And for many people, it turned out to be 5 years and 10 years. You know.
Who was the friend that went with you?
A woman by the name of Joan Primo. Good, radical young woman from then, from Fargo, that we had done some political stuff on campus together.
Did she stay in Delano for a while then?
She stayed with the union Yeah, she did. She stayed with the summer program, and I think she stayed on with the union about 2 years, something like that, you know, in different capacities.
Do you know where she is now? Or just
she's, I bumped into her in a movie theater about 2 years ago, and she's married to a professor at Berkeley and has children, and I don't recall if she's, just raising the children now or if she's working. But I didn't have a good long talk with her, but I suspect, I think her politics are probably pretty much in the same place they were many years ago.
Okay. So when you get to Delano as a, that, you know, summer volunteer group, what do you do? What's your reaction? What, you know, what do you see? What do you get involved in?
It was very exciting and very, very positive. It's, you know, it was almost unreal. We were going to begin on a get together, I think, on a Sunday, something like that, and got together in a little town right near Fresno. I'll think of that maybe one of these days too, but. We got together, all the group came together, and what's his name played a big role in that introduction to the union from Teatro,
Luis Valdez.
Luis Valdez.
So you were at Del Rey, maybe?
Yeah, it was Del Rey.
The theater had a center there, right?
Yeah. Okay. And I think we went first to Delano and did some little sessions together. Would it have been? It wouldn't have been the 40 acres yet. It would have been out there on their, wherever their first headquarters were. And then we went from there, I don't remember anymore, a day or two later to Del Rey and did like more lengthy work on boycott strategy and the background of the farm workers and what the plans were at that point. But it was very positive. It was like a very unifying kind of thing. People were all there. I suppose with various maturity, you know, politically, but all kind of together on the idea that the plight of farm workers had to be changed and that this process or this organization might be a way to help do that.
Were there people in that group from COR and SNCC?
Yeah, there were. People that had firsthand experience with SNCC and COR.
Do you remember any names?
You know, I don't quite honestly. I know Marshall Gans came. He had some work with SNCC down south. Mm-hmm. And I know there were some others, but I don't remember the, you know, which people they were.
I think I read somewhere that they brought you in to help train in nonviolence.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, because they had had the experience, you know, in down south, they did rely upon some of them from SNCC.
Well, I think in one of the texts it's reported that that's why you went there.
Oh, you're kidding.
No, I think I've read that.
Yeah, I never had any firsthand experience in that. I helped put together friends of SNCC on campus, and we were supportive economically and politically of that, but no, I wasn't brought in for that. I was brought in with that large group of kids who were invited to come in and spend the summer with the union.
So after the training or the initial introductory training in Del Rey, then what happens?
We did some, you know, things were pretty
poorly planned. You know, I mean, I don't think Caesar and leadership quite knew what buttons to press, you know.
Well, one of the things we heard is that this first call for volunteers, they had no idea how many people would show up, and they were kind of overwhelmed with the numbers
really?
That showed up.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've been told.
I don't doubt that.
Yeah. So.
But we picketed some stores, and we picketed some grape fields. Mm-hmm. And did some things. We weren't around very much long. We weren't around very long before they sent us out, and I was sent with John Primo. And another kid that's in town here, David Perlin, we went up to Seattle to try to put the boycott together. And looking back, we didn't know jack about putting a boycott together. But, you know, I think everybody in the union pretty much learn by doing, you know, just getting out there and banging away and finding something that worked and doing it. But we were sent up there to do a boycott. And
so what did you do? You were sent there and you said, you know, you hadn't had a lot of experience with this. And you
one thing we did
pretty effectively from the start was we knew we had to go to labor organizations and church organizations and radical organizations and raise money. So we...
You had to support your own operation, right?
Yeah, we did, you know, and in fact, pretty much all through the years, that was always very successful. But we did, that's most of what we did, is we went around to different organizations and spoke. We'd have a little rap put together, and the goal was to try to be speaking to different groups every day and every night, and to offer that to, we'd get endorsements for the Great Boycott, and we would... ask for money, which organizations were very good in doing. They gave us a lot of support. In terms of putting a real effective boycott together that you could measure, that never occurred. It actually occurred probably within 2 years of that, because we came back from Seattle and I did some work with the migrant ministry, and then I was sent out to Portland, Oregon. And by the time we got to Portland, Oregon on the boycott, I don't remember the damn year anymore, we were able to actually begin measuring impact, you know, by car lots of grapes. We had this great guy, Ken Blum, who's, I think, is probably still working and living in Chicago. But he brought technical shit to... How do you measure a boycott, a grape boycott, right? And he figured out and how to get information on car lots that went to cities over the years, and then to compare it, right? And he got so good and precise. I mean, he could measure the kind of production year it was, and then translate that to the actual car lots, so we could actually begin measuring. We truly could measure without bullshitting ourselves whether we were having an impact. It's one thing, you know, because a lot of stores, for example, never supported the boycott, but a lot of stores did quit advertising. You know, and how do you measure that, right?
Yeah.
You know, are you kidding yourself or is it real? Well, we began to see that the numbers from, and then we began plotting all the major cities, like probably 30 different markets. We could then be able to really measure the impact of the boycott by 19. When was the year the growers signed? Was it 76? Yeah, but the big raft of grape growers that came in was 70. So by 1970, we could measure it, we could taste it, and we were humming. I mean, it was in most cities, it was really happening, and you know, which led to the pressure of the growers marching in and signing that big raft of contracts at that point.
Did you have any contacts or anything when you went to Seattle the first time out?
They gave us a couple names, you know, and I think they were both like old-time radicals. They may have been communists. I'm not sure. Maybe I'll remember while we're talking here, but they were old radicals, I think from the Longshore Union.
When you went to town, then did you find a house?
We went and did the same thing we did for years after, and that was we went and contacted these people, and they opened their house to us and gave us free lodging, you know. So the three of us lived in this Longshore. Actually, this guy was a seaman, and his wife. Him and his wife were both old radicals from the Seattle area, and they opened their house, and always very, very positive, friendly, and supportive, and helped us then begin reaching out to the radical and labor community. And they had also had a lot of experience by then in the anti-nuclear movement and radical movement in Seattle. So they just started really helping us connect up with all of these groups that turned out to be very helpful.
That went on all over the country then?
I think so.
I mean, this is one more important tie with other individuals, radicals, unions, etc., help make this movement go.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and Virginia probably told you, we had the experience of working in many different cities on the boycott, And invariably, we got good help from the old left and the old anti-nuclear people and civil rights people. They were always there, and they were always, I don't know of an occasion where they were negative. You know, they were always positive in helping us push and build the boycott. They were very key, I think the left and church groups were very key in the pickets that provided us the picket lines against the grocery stores and later the liquor stores, which brought us success. They were key in being those week-in and week-out people that put together our delegations and our picket lines.
Did you ever give any thought to or see any conflict between church people and lefties?
Not only did we,
not
only did we see it, we watched its development and growth, and I mean, we literally had communists and little old church ladies on the same committees and knowing each other's politics, and we watched them grow, and and I'm sure you might have guessed by now or heard, but you know, the union had a really good radicalizing effect upon people. And by the times people had worked together for a few months in a real struggle, you know, against these chain stores and things we were doing, most of the time everybody landed right and they were very supportive, much more open to each other's ideas, and very positive.
Yeah, Chris Hartmeyer told us a story about a busload or two busloads of people that came in from an ecumenical council, and half of them went out on the line that faced the Teamsters and got arrested, and the other half went off to a boycott or something, or they just marched for the day and then got on the bus and went home. And he says all the people that were on the line that got arrested, he said part of the story was he told them, well, if you get arrested, we'll get you out in a couple 3 days. It took them a couple 3 weeks.
Wow.
But they all marked that as a highlight of their lives. And the ones who went on the boycott were lying, where nothing happened. Said,
But it's funny,
you know,
isn't it?
They got kind of shortchanged, in fact. After all, I could have been with the other group.
Yeah, you know, and the thing is, when you talk about people moving, you know, that was really one of the highlights of my experience with the union, was to watch how people grew, you know, politically. But you could see it. I mean, once they get banged around by a rent a cop at a chain store office or arrested or, you know, all of those things that happen, I'm telling you, it just propels them along. And people were generally, we saw hundreds of people radicalized, you know, from no politics to beyond the fact they want to see migrant workers help to becoming very radical. And I think, too, and I don't know if anybody's ever tried to measure it, probably not, but I know the Farm Workers Union left thousands and thousands of radical, good political people in its wake, you know, in these cities, you know. And in spite of, if the union were to die tomorrow, it'll never die because of the, you know, all of that work that occurs. We got people radical and involved, and I know they followed up when the boycott wasn't there anymore. They were into radical environmental politics and, you know, good stuff.
Did you respond to that in a cognizant way in terms of trying to accelerate it or say, look, we can use this to our advantage if we do this the next time we're out, or taking lessons from it?
Yeah, we took lessons regularly from it. And, you know, we found keys to making the boycott work. And once we found that key, we jammed, you know, with it. And it worked. Virginia and I had a very, very successful boycott situation everywhere we went. You know, and maybe some of it was luck. We learned from everything we did from Portland, Oregon for the next 10 years. We learned, and by the time we were getting into final year or two of doing boycott work, I mean, the union had it down to a good science. You know, so we could, we took on the last boycott I participated in when I was boycott director was Dole boycott. And we knocked out Dole products out of more chain stores in a quicker period of time than any other previous boycott. I don't remember the number anymore, but it seems to me, I recall maybe as many as 30 or 40 different chain stores had taken some or many of the Dole products out in like less than 2 or 3 months. It just went.
How'd you do that?
In about 35 cities, we had an active, strong boycott committee. For example, in New England, we probably had 200 or 300 people who picketed 2 or 3 times a week. You know, so when they went to a delegation to a chain store and said, "We're coming after you if you don't do this and this," those chain stores by then were listening, and because they knew we had produced picket lines, which they didn't want. I don't know where I was at, but...
Well, I was trying to squeeze some of those techniques out of
it. Yeah.
Virginia mentioned shop-ins.
Shop-ins, mm-hmm.
What else?
Billboarding.
Yeah. Billboarding was a real strong...
Where did that come from? Mm-hmm.
We think it came from Portland while we were there. A kid, Chicano, he's an attorney now, and I think he's in the Bay Area or someplace. Jesus, what's his name? He came up with the idea. Mm-hmm. So I heard later somebody else claimed to have come up with the idea. But I never heard of it before. I never thought of it before. He came up with the idea. We happened to live in a boycott house in Portland, maybe 3 or 4 blocks from the freeway. And we went out one afternoon to go out to this chain store and promote the union. There was a big chain operation up there, Fred Meyer. Went out there with huge signs and got so much attention, and it immediately clicked because there was so much of, you know, thumbs up, and there was so much of this, you know, the finger in the air from people. It got such a strong reaction from doing it that we used it over and over again, and it's then spread to other cities. I think the Chicano, who was a son of migrant workers from the Portland, Oregon area, came up with the idea. And I hope I can remember his name before we're done here. And I'm not blowing hot air, we had very successful boycotts. And, you know, the way you measure them is in product, off shelves. Measure it with car lots that aren't coming anymore. In terms of picket lines and how many picket lines you can put out and how many people, you know, are on those picket lines, and in fundraising. Those are probably the 4 major ways. And we were very lucky, and in most cities we had enough time to see all of that happen very successfully, you know, so that we were most of the time, I think, raising as much money as we were spending, you know, out of the union's resources. Towards the end of our boycott work with the union in 76, we had 300 full-time staff, and about half of them had like upwards of 5 years experience, full-time experience with the union. And I know 100 of them I could send to any city in the world, and they could put a boycott together, you know, because they had the experience, and, you know, we knew the tactics. We had them down to a science by that time, and they could do it. And maybe even more than 100, but they were good. They had a lot of great experience, and they knew how to put boycotts together.
These are people that you had been training, been working with you?
Yeah, we did a lot of recruitment, and again, mostly colleges and young people were recruited in. And we would train them and pull them in. Many times there were people who were volunteering part-time that fell in love with the union and came on full-time. And they'd get their experience on a daily basis and learn and... We had a great, tremendously skilled staff by 1976. And many of those staff, too, by the way, were able and had been used to come over into different farm worker drives and were quite effective in helping organize in the fields also, a good number of them. So it was a tremendous, and we were raising, I think, the cost of the boycott then to the union might have been around $50,000 a month, and we were raising that and more per month in
donations.
Yeah. I mean, I've had some unbelievable experiences during those years. I mean, I remember I traveled with Caesar once in a while because I helped work on his security. In fact, I think I set up his first formal security in 1971 or 72, somewhere in there. At any rate, just a good example of the tremendous support that was built and knit together at that time. You know, I remember Caesar speaking to the Michigan AFL-CIO convention, and I remember the president taking the checkbook, putting it in the air before the delegates, says, "Caesar, come organize Michigan, we will pay every penny it'll cost. You know, I mean, it was that kind of real support that was just there, you know. Nobody was saying no to supporting the union, you know, from the typical suspects, you know, the church groups and radical groups. And many unions that were very conservative ended up doing some shit that they never intended to do.
For example, you got some examples?
Well, we were in constant tension, for example, with retail clerks, who was quite conservative union.
And you're picking it outside the stores?
Yeah, drove them nuts. They were on our ass all the time and trying to shut us down and stop us. So for many periods of time, all we were doing was boycotting the grape or the lettuce or the wine because of the union. Boycotting the store. You know, we'd find a way to make sure we stopped customers from going to the stores because that's the thing that really had the power. But we were always in conflict with them. But and on many occasions, at many different levels, you know, national AFL-CIO conventions and all of that, they had to put their conservatism in their back pocket, many times reluctantly, I'm sure, because the union had become acceptable and a, you know, valued thing that the union movement decided collectively it better get behind, even though many times it wasn't as behind, it was not as supportive as it should have been. A lot of conservative unions bit their tongue and supported it. And in some cases, I remember real right-wing teacher union bureaucrats from New York City finally getting behind it and going out and getting arrested and doing stuff I'm sure they didn't intend to do. Yeah. And then that's the other value, too, of the union had. It did help radicalize and give a lot of good ideas to the union movement. It hasn't used them very well. But it's had its impact, and I think it'll have its impact, you know, in future years. And a lot of the staff I was talking about ended up in the, you know, other unions. I know there's got to be 50 or 100 people, if not 500 people, that are working full time in the union movement across this country that worked at one time with the union. There's lots of them. I bump into them all the time. I was in a shitty little Teamsters hall in Salinas. A few months ago and bumped into a volunteer who's now a hard worker, good radical hard worker in the Teamsters local there in Salinas. You know, so people don't float away. Not everybody floated away and out to other things.
There's a lot of people in unions. I mean, when we track people down, we find a heck of a lot of them in union offices. One of the smaller points I'd like to cover. You were in Chicago for a while, right?
Mm-hmm.
And were you up there? Were the Chandlers up there at the same time you were? Bill and Irene Ronald?
Actually, Virginia and I went to Chicago for our first official assignment there. We replaced them.
So you worked with Jesse Jackson, Operation Breadbasket up there?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, they probably did a lot more, and I think LSL Medina probably did a lot more work with them than we did, and I'm not quite sure why. We were in Chicago a fairly short time, if I remember. It may have been as short as 6 or 8 months, and then Caesar was getting these threats and the drug and, what do they call it, Bureau of Drug and Alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, got information off some phone taps that they'd put a hit on him, something with some grower. And I have no idea why, but I was asked to come back and try to organize some security around Caesar, which I did. And so we didn't have a lot of time in Chicago. We never got that rich, you know, involvement that I know Chandler's had and LSL Medina had there for Chicago. Because we were just not there very long.
Were there people along the way that were especially good allies that you remember?
Good allies, you mean from outside?
Your boycott days?
Well, speaking generally, I'll tell you, you know, I can think in general terms, definitely got good support from the Unitarian churches and the you know, some of these old peace groups that were part of the church, came out of the church movement, Council of Church type people. So, like, churches were, you know, a good number of church people were always present in the cities we worked in. The radical left was always there, and the older radical left, and I'm guessing, I'm not certain of this, but my guess is that the old communist groups were always very supportive. We didn't go to a city where they weren't actively participating in the picket lines and doing support work for the union. So, like, broad groups like that, and then student groups, and students, mostly radical student groups, were always present, you know. So, like, those, to me, were foundation, you know.
Did you get some celebrity support in some of these areas that sort of stimulated other people to come in?
The union did. I don't know. You know, we got a politician here and there, which, like in Portland, a well-known radical state assemblyman, you know, was supportive, and that helped us. That brought in some wider groups of people that probably wouldn't have come. Let me think. And I know that the union had lots of celebrities participate in different demonstrations and things, and politicians. Barney Frank was very helpful to Virginia and me and the union in Boston, for example. He was just getting his political teeth in and was well known. He participated in our first A&P demonstration. He was very helpful.
Did things that might have been televised or hit the papers or something back here, Joan Baez's concerts and stuff like that, did you feel a ripple effect from them at the boycott sites?
Yeah, I think we were buoyed by that type of support, you know, and it became obvious. I mean, hell, we began using some of those celebrities and Virginia and I were in Delano during the fast.
Okay. And that's when you're doing security?
Yeah.
Okay, well, then there's a couple things I want to talk about, then backing up that you mentioned earlier. You talked about coming back while going to Seattle and coming back and doing some work for Migrant Ministry.
Yeah.
What was that? What was that?
Chris Hartmeyer and Migrant Ministry had put together a worker priest program.
Mm-hmm.
And it came out of a French idea, apparently, where priests actually worked at work. Typical work that people do in their, and that was their ministry, right? And their idea in Migrant Ministry was to have this cadre of worker priests who would work somehow, inject us into the farm worker situation in the fields, and we would be worker priests. But we had, of course, our goal was to organize workers. Mm-hmm. And so I participated in that for God, I don't know how long. I don't know what the hell year. That must have been about 69, somewhere in there. But a group of us, some minister types, myself and some farm workers, went into that program to give it a try. It was an idea which didn't do much or go anywhere. But
you weren't a priest.
No, I wasn't.
And I know some of the other people involved in that, at some points, for example, several of them went to Union Theological.
They had religious training.
Right. You had religious K-12,
Right.
But not.
Yeah, and I don't even remember why again.
Okay. Now they had a migrant ministry team concept working at that time, where you had ministers, but also
non-ministers.
Non-ministers.
Right. Right.
Was that what
and
was
I was one of those non-ministers.
So what did you do as part of these teams?
You know, I mean, I think Chris and the church were serious about, I mean, they gave invaluable help to the union. There's no question about that. But I think they were constantly looking for ways to bring in church money and turn that into people and, you know, to really help the union, right?
So migrant ministry then just became a way of
a tool.
Supporting you to keep you doing what you were doing.
That's my honest belief, I think, was that it was a way of bringing church support in, having a, you know, representation of good work from the church directly helping the farm workers, but also to help drag money and support in directly into the union. And to train organizers, people that could go into the fields and help the union train organize workers.
So what was it then you were doing in this? What would a typical day be like?
Well, number one, we went out and got some firsthand experience in the fields. So we picked wine grapes, we picked oranges, we thinned trees, thinned them. Process that goes on before they
This was your first experience actually?
I had actually worked, I forgot to mention, but I had worked a couple summers in onion fields along with migrant workers back in North Dakota. So it wasn't my first taste of heat and sweat and most hateful work in the world. So we did some thinning of trees, some fruit picking, orange picking, wine, grape picking. And then we came up with, we were going to try to break Jamara, one of the big grape growers. We thought they were an important grower to try to break. So we went in to try to infiltrate the different crews. At this time it was fall, early winter, and they were doing the thinning in. And so I ended up working with at Jamara for maybe upwards of a month, thinning Thompson grapes. Not thinning, pruning. And we were able to successfully pull a bunch of Jamara crews out on strike by that winter or spring. I don't even remember when it occurred. So that was like it. And then I think rapidly after that, after we did that, we were out on the boycott again to Boston, if I remember right.
And so you did... You did some swing through Chicago, Boston, New York.
Yeah, we actually Virginia wasn't important, but as she probably told you, she was Caesar's secretary. We went our first boycott together was Portland. That's right. Went from Portland back to California, then Boston. No. Jesus, it's amazing. Seattle was my first boycott. Then we went to Portland and back to California. And then Minneapolis. I sent to Minneapolis, Kansas City, Chicago. And then from Chicago back to La Paz and the security stuff. Again, Virginia worked in the boycott department. And from there, we went out to Boston, New York City, and then back to...
Security. Let's talk about security.
And what do you want? Turn your machine off a moment.
We're aware of the situation in one of the other interviews that there was a contract on Caesar, and then security then wasn't just kind of patrolling perimeters, but there was some serious... considerations.
Yeah. I guess I was asked to come back to La Paz to try to organize a security group around Caesar, probably because I had grown up, I was a hunter. I grew up in North Dakota. I hunted 6 months out of the year. I loved it and had a lot of experience with firearms and had further experience in ROTC training and firing of weapons. And so I was recruited to do that, and I was brought back, and, you know, the implications of the threats against Caesar were laid out very clearly by, he's in Sacramento now, Leroy Chatfield. He had the most hands-on knowledge along, I think, with Jerry Cohen of what the implications were, but it was clear that the government had turned over information that a hitman, a person that makes his living killing people in California, they were tapping his wire for some other reason. And that became clear that a grower or growers had put up money, substantial money, to have Caesar killed. And so that warning was given to the union, and I came back in, and we put together, I believe it was like five or six of us into a team that went out then, and I trained people on how to use pistols and shotguns and rifles. And we attempted to get the knowledge and, you know, real experience from people. Like, I remember Ted Kennedy's security person had given the union a lot of information on how to set up for public appearances and things like that. So we used a lot of information from him. I don't remember his name anymore. And we put together, I think, a pretty good security detail. Now, and we did a lot of things, smart things, I think, which are helpful. But if you know enough about security, you understand there's really nothing you can do if people are determined with rifles and scopes and or bombs. They can eventually, you know, get to you. But we set this up, and we determined that we would precede Caesar every place he went, every appearance, and we would check out even neighborhoods, even, but particularly areas and meeting halls and things for the obvious, you know, bombs or strange-looking people. We would set up an attempt to watch people coming into these meetings to try to figure out if they were armed or not. And I think we had a pretty, as limited as security can be, I think we had a pretty sharp security operation going. And, you know, once in a while we would get a flag, you know, we would see something that was unusual or strange enough so we would derail the next meeting for Caesar that he intended to go to. Some of it got real, very real, too. We caught a guy coming into a church in New York City with a gun under his suit jacket. And so we pulled Caesar out of there, and we went to a movie theater and watched a movie instead of him speaking that night. We were in a large fundraising event in Rhode Island. What's the capital there? Whatever, the biggest city in Rhode Island. And we always, you know, looked and checked every individual out we could. You know, we really did a real scrutiny. We saw two people we thought really stood out as being weird. You know, they just stood out. They weren't like all of the rest of the crowd. They were young guys with white belts, and they just didn't look right. And they looked a little rough, right? So we got their photograph, and somehow we got information through the police department or somebody. You know, how did we get that? Whatever. By the time the event started, like this trying to figure these guys out had gone on for an hour or two. By the time we got close to Caesar speaking, we decided to get out of there and leave. And we found out later. That's what we did. We found out later because we had the photographs that these guys were hitmen for the Trafficante, whoever runs the mob in Rhode Island, and that these guys were hitmen. So you don't know. We were having tremendous problems with the Teamsters at that point, and there's no doubt in my mind that you wouldn't need the growers to go after Caesar during some of those periods. Some of the mob toes we were stepping on in boycotting and picketing fruit stands and, you know, product which has a lot of relationships to the mob in some cities, that with the Teamsters thing was plenty of reasons to try to set some security up around Caesar. But I think those two occasions prove that, you know, we don't know obviously what if anything would have happened, but I think it proved the value of security. And maybe it prevented something from happening, you don't know.
Must have been a fairly tense, stressful time for you.
Yeah, it was. It was pretty stressful. The stress was always there for all of us, and but it wasn't terrible. I mean, it wasn't something that derailed us. It just, there was more tension there in trying to worry about protecting his life, I think, than if we were doing something else in the union.
Yeah, compared to boycott work, you can, you know, at some point, 11, 12, 1 o'clock at night or in the morning, you can close the office and rest. You know?
Yeah, no, we had some pretty rough details, too. I mean, we spent many a 24-hour period straight, you know, with Caesar in different situations.
But you remember what your reaction was, or how, you know, how it affected the pause when you got word from the FTA about the threat? And the
people were very, you know, I guess a lot of us probably close to the movement thought there was always that risk, right? Because we knew who the growers were. But I think we all were pretty much in shock. It was very sobering to find out that they actually had some information on that. So I remember it was a very sober time in La Paz when we first got over there and began putting plans together around it. And
were you the least bit intimidated by this task?
I was stupid, I guess. I wasn't. I've always been stupid, and I wasn't intimidated.
Well, you were younger then.
I was a good shot. I always have been a good shot. I felt very comfortable around firearms. And even though my philosophy around firearms and things have changed over the years, I was very comfortable. I felt comfortable taking the task on. And probably much, looking backwards, much more confident than I should have been about maintaining security, because it's just one of those things you can't do perfectly.
One of the points we wanted to pick up again too is the question of the involvement and participation of women. The typical book tells you, well, Dolores was there, and she's the vice president, and she was a negotiator, and she was a speaker, and she was.
When you see the old films, the videos, you know, whether it's Fighting for Our Lives, the Decision of Delano, or news clips, you constantly see women in these films. Could you talk about what you saw as, you know, being there for 10 years, the role, the participation of women, and mention, you know, some of the ones that...
Well, one of the things that's clear... absolutely clear very early in Delano and around the farm worker movement is the women were a very, very strong backbone, I think, to carry for the movement. They were there, if I remember right, they seemed to always be there in more numbers than men, like on Friday night meetings. They were always doing hard, long hours in the different projects the union had going on, maintaining the offices and the rest. So they were absolutely, you know, and I don't know if anybody measured it, but they were very instrumental, very much probably had more impact in the early years there than the men, I think. You know, and it's a guess on my part, but they were absolutely present. The men were many times involved in more of the exciting picket line details and stuff, but the women were always there. The women were on the picket lines too, and leading them in many cases. But I think my images of the union, thinking back into the offices and the different things that the union was doing at that time, you know, I see women. You know, the women were there, and absolutely clear in boycott work, by the way, that women were a very, very significant part of the hard work that went on in the boycott. You know, I think many more women were on those picket lines in all of my experience than men. And that was always a constant. And I don't know why, but they definitely played a big role in the boycott. And a lot of leaders, of course, in the boycotts were women.
Who were some of these women? Who are they?
Let's see if I can think of some names. There's a woman here now that works, I think she's working with SEIU. let me think of her name. God, I've always been bad at names, so bad at names. I'll think of it. I mean, Vivian Levine is in the Bay Area here. She did a lot of great work on the boycott. One of the women, I think, that's still at La Paz is an attorney now, did a great boycott work. I don't recall her name. She's a Chicana. Virginia, of course, was a tremendous leader in the boycott, and I think was very instrumental in the successes we had through the years. God, I've got these visions. I'm going to try to bring the names up for you. I don't remember, besides Dolores, very many Chicanas out of the farmer movement who were very successful at boycotting, although they were out there and they were participated in it.
What about another, you know, in addition to the to boycotting, you know, the other activities? You mentioned the office, but there's, you know, there's a whole series of other activities, the PR, the publications, the... Mm-hmm. You know, just a whole range of, of activities.
Right.
What about somebody like FINA?
They were always there and always putting in the long hours, making the things happen that the union had decided had to happen, right? Mm-hmm. And the different, the credit union and the other little
the service center.
Service center stuff that had been set up. Yeah. They were always there.
Yeah. Esther?
And Esther, too. Mm-hmm.
Helen,
Constant. Yeah. And they're all tough, and they all never bullshitted about, never complained.
Can you give us a few examples of this toughness and non-bullshitting?
They talk like I'm talking right now. Okay. You know, it was, you don't, you know, they were very serious. Mm-hmm. They had a good sense of humor and everything, and I think they had a healthy disrespect for some of the liberals that... they had a respect for people that helped the union, but they also had a healthy internal disrespect for some of the liberal stuff that they had to put up with in accepting support. You know, you could imagine, we'd get typical white liberal coming through. I remember one guy who came through, ended up writing a book about Caesar and the union. A fairly young white guy, who was so backward on racism and so obnoxious, you know, he didn't even realize it. But, you know, like FINA and Helen and them, you know, they gave them quite a bit of latitude, but, in their own circle, they would laugh or they'd put a person with those problems down very severely. And in terms of actually working with full-time people in the union who had problems of race or paternalism, they were very direct and blunt about it. They would challenge that.
How about sexism? I mean, that's kind of endemic in our society, and it had to be. I mean, today, we, even with 20-25 years of the contemporary phases of the women's movement, the feminist movement, we still have problems with that.
There was, and there probably continues to be, a fair amount of sexism. I mean, we suffer historically from that in all our institutions, including the Farm Workers Union. But, like back into the earliest years, for example, I remember the Friday night meeting watching Salt of the Earth, which I think has a very strong anti-sexism theme, among others. And, you know, that hit was so devastating. That hit home so hard. You know, I remember people bawling after watching it because it showed visions of what they were actually going through in the picket lines and the grape fields.
It's kind of a validation because, you see, it's not just you. Sometimes, you know, if you're not careful, you think something's wrong with me.
Yeah,
but when you see it.
But there was a very early, I think, recognition of the strength of women and the role they might play. And even though it was far from perfect, I think our organization was ahead of a lot of others on that, and maybe out of necessity because the women were, we needed them to do what had to be done. But also, you know, we had a lot of flavorings of the left, which were more advanced on mm-hmm. sexism at that point, and so they were constantly kind of, you know, introducing those themes into thinking and meetings of the movement, which helped propel. I know that a lot of the sexism that I have in me, had in me, was kicked out of me by some very tough women who wouldn't put up with it, you know, very, very strong on the issues. And I had to change my, and like many other men, I think, in the movement, we got an education, and nobody's perfect, but we got a very quick education on those issues in the early years.
In a couple of the interviews, the summer volunteer programs that started, and you know, were apparently more successful than some of the people who put them together thought they were going to be, and also the idea being that there'd be, you know, some people around for the 3-4 months of the summer, then they're gone, that many of the summer volunteers chose to stay. One of the items brought up in reference to the summer program was that it brought in a fair number of college trained, at least partially college trained, college attending women who were in the early phases of this, you know, this round of the women's movement, and that brought in a whole other perspective that had to be dealt with.
I think that's true. I think that is true, and it mixed with the reality of the women having to do the hard work they were doing in the movement. You know, the farm worker women, you know, and the Helens, and I think that mix, you know.
Because this is what we're looking at, the various elements, perspectives coming in, and how they interact, and then what happens in terms of, it's almost like vectors where something's going, it's getting hit from different forces.
I think the reality of those women and what they were doing, how they were helping the movement move, you know, doing their hard work. I think that mixture with the ideology that came in from the outside, it met at a time, and it reinforced some good things, you know, on those issues in the union. And again, the union has got its sins and will continue to, I'm sure, on those issues, but still we were pretty advanced.
The other part of the other aspect coming, like somebody like yourself coming in from a progressive left perspective, and then, you know, working on staff with the union, a union made up of farm workers, many with little formal education, some having had, for example, there's several people, the Corcoran cotton strike, they were still around, people like Julio involved in some of the later strikes, so it's not like this thing is in a vacuum, but once again, the bringing in of volunteers from the outside also introduces a range of political perspectives.
Yeah.
Did you see that happening?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Sure I did.
Were there tensions around? I mean, there had to be tensions, but what were some of the tensions around that?
Well, the politics that came in, the radical politics, I was always, thanks, you're offering, is there more? See, you get some. I was always offering my 3 cents on politics. And I never tried to hide my politics among co-workers and Caesar and everybody else I worked with. But, you know, not a lot of tensions. You know, the tensions that arose in the union and also sometimes in the boycott cities, you know, quite honestly, some left groups would try to ride the farm worker horse, you know, for their own advantage, right? So those things rose, come up from time to time. Internally, I don't think a lot. You know, there was some run-ins, I think, ideologically with Caesar and some of the top leadership, with a few individuals who I think had a political agenda, which was more important than the farm worker agenda. And Caesar and Richard and Dolores and other leaders didn't have much time for that. But on the other hand, I was always labeled and openly a strong leftist who believed in socialism and all the other good things in life. And I, all the way to the end, got along perfectly with top leadership. And I saw how other left people ideologically got along very well, I think, mm-hmm. with the top leadership of the union and with the ranks. There's
a range in the ranks, too.
Yeah, there is. There is. But, you know, I've heard from various sources there was more conflict there maybe than I was aware of, you know, around ideology. Mm-hmm. But quite honestly, I don't think the leadership went after any particular left ideology mm-hmm. because, you know, they hate the left ideology. I think they went after it from time to time because these are, I remember my experience in Boston. We had a political organization which clearly made its agenda was to take over the boycott apparatus in Boston mm-hmm. and ride it, you know, for its own organizational needs. So we had a conflict there, and we sorted it out, and a lot of them never came back to help again, mm-hmm. you know, but we're not. And I know that some things like that probably happened in California in around the headquarters and whatnot, but not a lot.
Yeah, there was definitely an array of groups out there that would say things like, well, you're a mass organization or a popular organization. We're a fill-in-the-blank revolutionary mm-hmm. vanguard
right.
or whatever, and
right.
so that it's time for us to take your wonderful mass popular organization and head in the right direction.
Right.
I mean, that's
right.
kind of paraphrasing. I'm sure you heard that.
Right,
yeah,
absolutely.
Time and time again, and
yeah.
that, of course,
yeah,
would,
absolutely.
Would present some problems for an organization that has a goal.
Mm-hmm.
Set of tactics to match that
yeah.
goal.
Then, you know, you after you get a little experience trying to build a volunteer boycott operation, you don't have a litmus test.
Yeah.
Well, there is one,
yeah.
and that is that people produce,
yeah.
that people picket, that people support the movement, right, and don't come to a meeting to derail it,
yeah.
you know. And once in a while, a group would come to derail it because they had their other desires for their own organization. But I think that, you know, we were talking earlier about the, you know, women coming in from the outside and bringing the feminist message in, and that's true. And there were some very tough women there that, on their own level, maybe ideologically, they didn't have any fine-tuning of the people from the outside, but they were strong, you know.
Yeah.
They
didn't have the articulated
yeah.
ideology that the university...
All I know is they didn't want to take bullshit, right? And particularly from men,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
dumb men. Yeah.
Dumb men that posture a lot at Friday night meetings. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, and I don't believe the women probably were given the strong recognition with the... Maybe Dolores is even Dolores sometimes probably should have had more recognition at different periods than she got for the leadership she provided. But so it ain't totally healthy. But on the other hand, it was a lot healthier than other things, other groups we were working with. You know, we're pretty advanced on that question.
I want to back up a little bit and ask you about your role at the FAST. I know at least one of the texts says something about your setting up the camp, the vigils, and is that something you initiated, fell into, or was some work that had to be done, or how did that come to pass?
Well, turn your machine off a moment. Let's see, where were
we? We were asking you about your role in the past.
Well, Caesar announced his fast at Filipino Hall and described it in terms of he felt the movement needed to reassess its vision. And I don't remember what all. I'll have to reread a book or two on it again to remember. But everybody was pretty shocked and moved by it. And I remember Virginia and I and some others deciding to go out there and, you know, to hang in with them at the 40 acres and set up tents. And a lot of other people did the same, you know. And as looking backwards, it turned out to be a very, very big boost to the union because we got tremendous publicity off of the fast
And there was news media from all over the country that came in at one time or another during the fast, and some from outside of the country. So it became a very positive influence within the union, I think. I have no idea its impact on anybody's particular feelings about violence or nonviolence, but that was his motivation, and it helped boost, I think, recognition of the union and the boycott, and I know it had a big influence on our ability to recruit volunteers for our picket lines and stuff in the different cities.
So you stayed at the 40 acres for the duration of the past?
Yeah.
Would you describe that atmosphere? We've heard some stories about what it was like.
Well, we had like almost like rallies from time to time, but a lot of it was like we did masses, and it was very quiet and very formal, and people, as Caesar got sicker and sicker as he did, you know, people would come in, many of his longtime farm worker friends, hundreds if probably thousands came during that fast and visited him from time to time during the fast. So, and I was mostly involved with security work and stuff around there. And God, I don't know how big, on one or two of those occasions, I know we had thousands of people there during this fast.
There's a story around, I think even in one of the texts, about a woman that came all the way out on Garces Highway on her knees.
That's true. As far as I don't remember if I witnessed it myself. I have a clear vision of that. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of, as you guys know, I'm sure, there's a lot of strong religious ideology with Mexican-American farm workers, for sure. And some of that comes out, I think, particularly in the older farm workers who really were very much oriented to the union's respect for the church, and in many situations where priests were there at our sides on picket lines or at rallies, blessing the event. I think it had a lot of the older farm worker women, I remember for sure, were moved by that, and was probably one of the reasons why they were so tight and identified with the farm worker movement. But there was that type of thing where it wasn't extraordinary, thinking back now, that a woman would do that, because they did a lot of things, very sacrificial things during the hard times of the grape strike and whatnot, vigils. I mean, 1 day, 2 day, 3 day vigils outside of growers' property, you know, stuff that really took a lot of sacrifice. You know, I remember clearly the women being key in that, and very much almost everything that had any importance in terms of the picket lines and demonstrations, you would see the Virgin de Guadalupe and other religious articles present, mostly carried and brought in by the women.
What's the woman's name?
Dolores Campos.
Campos. She said she was one of the first cooks out at the, I guess out by the 40 acres over by Filipino Hall, but also, she said she often the rosary on evenings, and she didn't claim much for herself, but I had the impression that she was something of a spiritual leader. She said people would talk to her, and she would say, you know, just don't worry about it, just do what you have to do. The Virgin will take care of you. You know, it's a
I remember
the
some of
she
that.
Presented, it was a sort of a 12-step. Thing that surely helped people along. Do you
have
much sense of that?
You know, I'm not a religious person, and haven't been for many years, but I have a tremendous respect for what motivates people. And thinking back on the farm worker movement, I probably earlier, in my first years with the union, I kind of poo-pooed the religious element among farm workers. You know, but I came out later on having tremendous respect for it, because it was part of the glue that was there among the farm workers that helped keep that movement going around the Delano area. And so I came away respecting that. And then I saw how the religious side of it, you know, out in the cities, you know, the impact and the help we got and support we got from people who were religiously motivated, you know. And I came to the conclusion, I don't give a shit what motivates people if they do the right thing and help, you know. So I came away with a healthy respect both for that, what I consider kind of a super religious fervor of some of the farm workers. I respect it. Don't believe it, but I respect it, and as a motivating thing. And again, out in the cities, it was, I respect that because of the healthier parts of the church. And I'm talking about Jews, I'm talking about Protestants, Catholics, all those groups that helped. You got to respect it because you need it so badly, you know. And it, as it turns out, they were always there and present in the different efforts.
And during the fast, can you talk a little bit about the extent to which staff sort of geared up its publicity machine, if that's the case?
Yeah, I think that, you know, again, I guess my memory is, I think Leroy probably handled, we definitely used the fast to bring publicity around the union and around Caesars, you know, what was going on there. And I think in a very organized fashion, again, I wasn't involved with a lot of that, but I know Leroy and some of the top leaders of the union, I'm sure, made plans and put out all kinds of information to the media, which drew them in. You know, they just don't drop out of the sky mysteriously, you know. Some of it, of course, grew on its own. You know, once the publicity around it began to become known, I think, obviously, then media does come more spontaneously and did, I'm sure, in this situation. But I think probably Leroy was, and probably, I think Chris Hartmeyer had a lot of, his efforts went into the planning around what we were going to be doing at 40 Acres. Around the fast. And there were others there too, I'm sure, and Dolores and Richard. And I know the top leadership would have wanted to get as much publicity around it as possible to help the movement, mm-hmm. you know, because we saw it as a positive thing.
Well, speaking of publicity, maybe it's a bit of a leap, but as you were head of security for a while, did you travel with Caesar?
Mm-hmm.
Any, that was what period, what year?
It's probably 72 into 73, somewhere in there.
So you made those college tours and?
Yeah, I've been with them probably at 1,000 different functions, mm-hmm. you know, around the country, including some in Canada. And again, I don't recall a time where Caesar wasn't able to draw pretty good media attention, mm-hmm. you know, when traveling around the country. He was always a good draw, and I thought he was always very, very skillful in the message he presented.
Any of those, any nights stand out particularly, any particularly good rallies or speeches or anything that even sort of went beyond him his usual good self?
You know, I really, I can't say I was ever bored by hearing him, in spite of the hundreds of times I heard him. Mm-hmm. And he had a really good capacity to measure where we were at and where we had to get to, and then present it in a, such a personable way to the crowd that I was always very impressed. But, you know, there were tremendous rallies on some of the California campuses and you know, in Boston, we had a rally there. It was just, you know, really very rich. Probably the entire left and church movement of Boston, greater Boston area, was there, you know, for that. It was a tremendously successful.
Where was that?
It was in a large auditorium. I think it was at the University of Boston, if I remember right.
The
you would be. But, you know, very rich. I mean, I've been in meetings of where there's been thousands in the meeting hall, and they always were really good. It was, Caesar was always received very well. And his message, he had a really good way of communicating with people.
Do you use him directly as fundraisers? Do you collect funds at night?
Well, our staff would, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea how much something like that might have generated?
Lots of money. You know, when he would go into a meeting in a boycott city, some organization, labor group, invariably they'd end up writing a check for $5,000 or, you know, $1,000 or $10,000. People would have no hesitation pulling their checkbooks out and, you know, and really put money, not quarters. You know, when we were before labor groups and church groups and stuff, they contributed very profusely. We raised a lot of money. The union raised a lot of money through contributions.
Okay. So then your last boycott was, assignment was New York, right?
On the boycott, yeah.
On the boycott. And then you came back to La Paz?
Yeah. By that time in New York, we had regional directors, and I was East Coast director. Mm-hmm. And we had about probably 40 staff out east in very good, well-oiled boycott machinery set up.
You know, when you came back to La Paz, you were national director then, weren't you?
Right.
Before we pursue that, one thing before, it's out of sequence, but I don't want to forget it. I'd like to ask you to talk about individuals other than Caesar that were particularly influential for you out here. Were you close to or mentored you? Or, mm-hmm. I mean, were you close? I mean, I know you were gone a lot, but were you particularly close to Gil or mm-hmm. Julio or...
The leaders of the movement that had greatest impact on me, besides Caesar, were clearly Dolores, Richard Chavez, Gil Padilla. Chris Hartmeyer, Jim Drake, Eliseo Medina. I think those were probably the
did you
key people.
Learn different things from them or anything specific? Can you tell me about why you
Yeah, I think a lot of the boycott strategy, you know, we learned by doing it, right? But a lot of it also we got from different cities where they had different successes using different methods, and probably got the most good stuff, I think, from Eliseo Medina, who was very successful.
Virginia mentioned that he was extremely organized and...
Yeah, top-notch. Tremendous communicator, like Caesar, I think. Probably, to me, he was the closest thing to having Caesar's skills, you know, in terms of communicating and being able to encourage and get people to actually do things, you know, for the union. Tremendously talented guy.
Do you still work with Eliseo?
Eliseo works with a sister local of SEIU down in San Diego, and I see him from time to time, but we're so separate geographically that I see him maybe a couple times a year at meetings and stuff. And they're doing a lot of similar work that we're doing here.
I'd like for you to tell me a little bit about Gil. Everyone to a person mentions Gil.
Uh-huh.
Was so great and so important, but he's still a vague figure to me in some ways. He and Julio, we mentioned that, you know, founders or were there mm-hmm. in the first vice presidents, mm-hmm. and yet... don't really know much about him
mm-hmm.
or about Gil.
Mm-hmm. Well, I knew him. I think of him as a personal friend and tight. But you know, besides working in different offices at La Paz, I never worked directly with Gil. Gil was always very, very he's one of those spirits you like to have around. He's very positive. He had great humor, and, you know, I know he worked hard. He worked